Hello. On this week's program, 2005 in Review, we'll take a look back at the past year in the arts in our region and bring you the highlights of the news and the events and the people who made them happen. And what a year it's been. Together we've witnessed some superb performances and exhibitions and rediscovered so many great perennial treasures. And we weren't just here, but also overseas, travelling with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Pennsylvania Ballet as they brought their art to new audiences in Asia and the UK, and in Spain, where we went on a voyage of discovery into the life of Salvador Dalí. 2005 was a great year for the arts, and we'll try to remind you just how great in the next 30 minutes, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
In January, Malvern's People's Light and Theatre Company brought its production of Holes to the Academy of Music. Based on the book by Louis Socker, the play tells the story of Stanley Yelnats, sentenced to 18 months at Camp Greenlake for a crime he didn't commit. Director David Bradley said the transition to the Academy from the company's suburban Philadelphia home went seamlessly.
I like to think of taking the play to the Academy in terms of what the story is. These are boys in a giant dried-up lake bed digging. It's vast. It's open. So having a stage like the Academy stage and a house like the Academy's house fits the story. It's just, you know, you seize on that and say, well, okay, here's the big dried-up lake bed. And there are moments where actors talk directly to the audience. So to be able to throw the story out in that way, the story holds up to the size of the space. And I think the actors do too, and the design does too.
The following week, we met with Grammy Award-winning pianist Emmanuel Ax, one of today's most highly regarded musicians. Ax was in town to perform Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 27 with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Backstage at the Kimmel Center, we discussed how his life as a performer has evolved.
I think there are certain composers that are lodestones through your whole life, and I just think that it's something that you keep repeating through your life, and the pieces are so remarkably complex and inspired that they affect you through all periods of your life, and your viewpoint on them changes. With any luck, your performance changes and gets more interesting and deeper and explores many aspects of the music but can never take in all of it.
Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Christoph Eschenbach, with piano soloist Emmanuel Ax, in an excerpt from a January 05 performance of the Mozart Piano Concerto No. 27. In February, the Opera Company of Philadelphia staged a production of Aida, and Creatively Speaking's Theresa Madden was in it for 12 seconds. Almost every opera requires non-speaking, non-singing extras called supernumeraries, so for 2 months, Theresa rehearsed her all-action role as a twirling flower girl in Verdi's great tale of love and loss in ancient Egypt.
One night, as I entered the hall, I noticed something was different. Both the chorus and the stars were rehearsing with us. I felt a nervous shiver, like I was going to be detected in a lie, like someone was going to expect me to sing. It was then that I realized I was actually in an opera.
Also in February, a blockbuster Salvador Dalí exhibit opened at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Over the course of the next few months, the retrospective of the great surrealist's work drew 370,000 visitors to the area, a grand success by any measure. Prior to the exhibition, we had travelled through Dalí's beloved Spain and brought you our findings in a special programme. So on a sunny spring day, I talked with Philadelphia Museum of Art director Anne Darnancourt on the beach of the town of Cadaqués, Dalí's longtime home.
Cadaqués fascinated the Cubists, because you have all these beautiful little forms in light climbing up the mountain. It fascinated Dali more because he looked out to sea and saw these fantastic rock shapes and the shapes of the mountains weathered by the wind and the water.
In March, the Philadelphia Theatre Company staged a musical called Elegies, A Song Cycle. Written and composed by William Finn, the music is based on songs the playwright created for family members and close friends after they had died. Director Joe Calarco said the title belied the tone of the play.
He had originally called it Looking Up, which to me is more emotionally appropriate for what the show's about, than Songs of Mourning, because I don't think of them as songs of mourning.
Later that month, we visited the Allentown Band, the oldest concert band in the country, as it celebrated its 175th anniversary. We spoke with Ron Demke, the band's conductor, who explained that the band no longer marches. It just plays marches.
We have not marched since 1965. It's strictly a concert band. The history of the band is, of course, traditional in that it was used for military services and all sorts of functions, community functions, and used to parade quite frequently. The band actually played in four inaugural parades in Washington over the years, but that's history. We play traditional concert band music. It's music that is transcriptions from symphonic works, operatic works, Broadway musicals, and, of course, marches. John Philip Sousa predominantly, but lots of different marches.
The Liberty Bell March, performed by the Allentown Band. In April, the Philadelphia Shakespeare Festival opened its 2005 season with the Bard's comedic classic As You Like It, and 2 weeks later, Hamlet. While the festival was formed in 1996, this year marked the first time it ran in repertory, one cast performing in both plays, alternating productions and presenting both on one stage. Joshua Sharbuck, who among other roles played Hamlet, says repertory theatre forces actors to dig deep.
You have to be a real actor, a real chameleon. You have to be able to play one leading role one night and some curmudgeonly strange guy the next night. So it's a challenge, but one I think actors enjoy because they get to sink their teeth into such different things. And in a way, those inform what you do in one show. Sort of when you come back to the show you haven't done in a while, it sort of brings this whole freshness to it.
In May, Wilmington's DuPont Theatre played host to the touring production of On Golden Pond, starring James Earl Jones, who would later in the year receive a Tony nomination for his performance. We met with the voice behind Darth Vader, the Lion King's Mufasa, and Verizon, and discussed his character in the play Norman Thayer, and the challenge of overcoming the image of Henry Fonda, who played Thayer in the movie version of the work.
Well, I got lucky. And being of a different ethnic, it changes everything sort of automatically. I don't have to worry about changing the character to fit me, except to, you know, play it as I would be and try to live a parallel life to the character, you know, while I'm on stage. But no, it's a blessing in that case. I can't get Henry out of my mind, and I don't worry about it anymore. He's sitting on my shoulder like a guardian angel, and he probably gives me advice, whether I need it or not, you know, at times. I'm not saying I believe in ghosts, but I do believe in spirits that continue.
Also in May, we joined the Philadelphia Orchestra on a tour of Asia. We followed them through five cities in four countries across the continent. We went behind the scenes and spoke with orchestra members and support personnel, internationally renowned soloists, and of course, music director Christoph Eschenbach.
Because one plays every night in a different hall, or most of the nights in different halls, you have to be very, very awake and ready in your attitude to change totally quickly to the new acoustics.
The final leg of the orchestra's tour took us to Korea, which for orchestra concertmaster David Kim was a sort of homecoming. Kim was raised in the United States, but his parents emigrated from Korea. He was looking forward to his role as a soloist in a performance in the Korean capital, Seoul.
Most of all, I will feel a sense of humility mixed with pride. So proud that I can go back before, really, I would say my people, and be able to perform on the most exalted stage. I mean, with playing a concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra is as great as it gets.
In June, we visited the Banana Factory in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, a fruit distribution plant turned community art center and gallery. Established in 1998, the Banana Factory strives to kindle, support, and celebrate the artistic, cultural, and creative spirit of its neighbors through all kinds of art classes, summer jobs for inner-city youth, and an after-school program called Be Smart. The B, of course, stands for banana. 11-year-old Carla Mondonato was busily at work when we dropped by.
Pottery, and I like knitting. So basically, right now we're doing pots, and later we're going to glaze them, and if we want, we could make anything we want.
14-year-old Erica Carrera said she came to the Banana Factory for more reasons than just to make art.
Banana Factory is one of the best places in the world. The other best place is my house, even though there's nothing to do there.
Later in June, we were among the 120,000 people who attended the West Oak Lane Jazz and Arts Festival in Philadelphia. For one summer weekend, the sounds of jazz pour from the festival's three stages, and the smells of barbecue waft over an enthusiastic crowd. Warren Ory is the festival's co-organizer and artistic director. He says the annual event serves to both bring people together and expose new audiences to talented local musicians.
People right here in this city, which really is a mecca of jazz, have no idea who they're living next door to, who that guy taking out the trash is, and who the guy walking in the Super Fresh or whatever, you know? I mean, we need to know who is amongst us.
A muggy July was made more bearable by a great series of concerts at the Mann Center in Philadelphia's Fairmount Park, among which was a performance by jazz singer turned Broadway star turned popular TV icon. Bebe Neuwirth is best known for her role as Lilith in the sitcom Cheers, but she returned to her stage roots to sing with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center. Neuwirth studied jazz at Juilliard, then joined the Princeton Ballet before going on to a highly successful career on Broadway, where she earned 2 Tony Awards. Our interview was interrupted by what turned out to be a false fire alarm at her hotel. Undaunted by the approaching fire engine sirens, Neuwirth spoke of struggling with the decision to take on a television role.
It actually was a very hard decision to make when they asked me to actually be in the show and be a part of the cast, because I was working on Broadway, I was doing my 4th Broadway show, and then this happened, and I sort of felt like it would be, it would take me away from what I really love and what I really do, which is dancing on the stage. And it turned out that I was able to do both things at the same time. Every year that I did Cheers on the off season during the hiatus, I always did a musical theater piece.
Listen, your husband ain't home, is he?
No, her husband is not at home.
Find a flats, we're playing fast and loose.
And all that jazz!
Right up here is where I store the juice.
And all that jazz!
Come on, babe, we're gonna cross the sky. I met your lucky Lindy, never flew so high. 'Cause in the stratosphere, how could he lend an ear to all that jazz?
Oh, you're gonna see a shimmy, shimmy, shake.
And all that jazz.
Oh, she's gonna shimmy till her garters break.
And all that jazz. Jazz.
B.B. Newworth performing All That Jazz from the musical Chicago. In Philadelphia, she sang a program of songs by Kurt Weill and Kander and Ebb with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center. Later in July, we visited historic Rittenhouse Town, a preserved enclave tucked away in a corner of Fairmount Park. In its heyday during colonial times, the town had over 40 buildings and was the location of the first paper mill in the country. Now it's listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Commercial papermaking is long gone, but as Executive Director Andy Zellers-Frederick explained, the town's focus is now to preserve its legacy.
Paper was vital in the development of America. It was so important at the time of the Revolution that papermakers were exempt from military service. We were still importing over half of our paper by the time of the Revolution, and so we needed every scrap that we could get.
In August, Pennsylvania Ballet took Swan Lake, a new reimagined version of the classic work, to the International Festival in Edinburgh, Scotland. The show was a sellout with lines around the block each day for any return tickets. Audience reaction in the Scottish capital was overwhelmingly positive.
I thought it was fantastic. Really, really good. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
I thought it was absolutely magical. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was an experience.
It's good. Great.
Yeah.
I travelled from Philadelphia literally just to see this, and it was worth every second of it and more.
Fantastic performance. I'm very impressed. I must admit I hadn't heard of the Pennsylvania Ballet before, but their international class, fantastic.
I really enjoyed it. The music was wonderful, but first of all, the main dancer was great. I think she was great.
It's one of the most memorable things I've ever seen in my life. It was a fantastic performance.
Great. I really appreciated it. I will highly recommend it, and I think I will see it again.
While in Edinburgh, we were also able to witness 1812 productions taking a show to an albeit smaller world stage. All Wear Bowlers was a massive hit at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Actor and co-creator Jeff Sobel says the work draws inspiration from silent comedy-era heroes such as Laurel and Hardy.
We've called it a dreamscape vaudeville, and that's really what it is. I mean, it's a vaudeville that we've really tried to investigate that form about just old-school clowning and tried to make it present in audiences today so they really do get a kick out of it, that it's not just kind of a museum piece. But it also exists in this kind of beautiful, poetic dreamscape world so that, you know, all of a sudden you are flying, or all of a sudden you are, something magically appears in front of you and you don't. So that kind of the combination for us is really fun to do.
From the original Fringe in Edinburgh to Philadelphia's 10th annual Live Arts and Fringe Festival in September, where we submerged ourselves in the experimental wild performances staged all around the city. As part of the festival, Philadelphia saw everything from a nightly cabaret party to a patch of grass posing as installation art. WRTI critic-at-large Leslie Valdez gave us a little advice on how to navigate the overwhelming number of events in the festival.
If you don't know the artist, go for acts with intriguing titles or performances in tantalizing spaces. And oh boy, are there a bundle of both at this year's festivals. The 2005 Live Arts Fringe has grown so big you can bend like a pretzel trying to figure out what not to miss of its 200-plus events. But relax. You've got 2 weeks to experience some very affordable adventures.
One of the highlights of the Philadelphia Fringe was Patio Plastico, a dance piece written and directed by Brian Sanders. Like many pieces in the Live Arts Festival, the location helps shape the story. The dancers walk down the aisle of the theatre wearing empty plastic soda bottles as shoes. The stark contrast between the decaying grey concrete walls and the bright pinks and greens of the dancers' outfits creates a fantastical atmosphere. And Sanders says, in a way, fantasy is what he's after.
Part of the idea is maybe that it was more of my fantastical idea of what my childhood could have been, more so than what it is. And also just sort of wrestling with the idealism of how everything should be and how everything really is. This is not a literal representation, certainly. I mean, there's a family in this piece, but it's not like that's my family. Those are really all different parts of me.
In October, the legendary Julie Andrews marked her directorial debut in Wilmington with a production of The Boyfriend. Her role in the play's 1954 premiere launched Andrews to stardom. She would go on to perform some memorable film roles, including Maria Van Trapp in The Sound of Music and the lead in Mary Poppins. I met with Julie Andrews in Wilmington prior to the opening of The Boyfriend.
I am amazed at how much I know that I didn't know. And it seems to be using everything that I've ever learned about film or theatre or singing or music or dialogue or lyrics. It seems to employ every fiber of my being, and I find it very, very joyous, and I'm having a wonderful time doing this.
Also in October, the Philadelphia Museum of Art acquired a painting by Norwegian painter Edvard Munch called The Mermaid. The 18-foot-long trapezoidal work depicts a mermaid poised at the edge of a sandy moonlit lagoon. Elsbeth Schosko, curator of the Munch Museum in Oslo, said the meaning behind the enigmatic mermaid depends on who's viewing it.
It could be interpreted in several ways, as just a plain fairy tale figure for children or this sexual symbol.
In tandem with the Philadelphia Museum of Art exhibit, the Lantern Theatre Company staged a production of The Lady from the Sea by another Norwegian, Henrik Ibsen. Considered the father of modern drama, Ibsen is better known for some of his other plays, but Lady from the Sea director Catherine Nocero said this play forms a valuable link to much of Ibsen's other work.
It is a rarely performed play, and what's so interesting for the people who are familiar with, you know, A Dollhouse or Hedda Gabler or The Wild Duck is Ibsen himself and his critics have also said that of his 12 realistic plays, they all formed an interrelated cycle, and that thematically one is answering the one that came before or commenting in a new way on the themes that most interested Ibsen.
In November, for a performance of Mahler's Sixth Symphony, the Philadelphia Orchestra created a new percussion instrument to produce an unearthly, ominous sound the composer called Hammer Blows of Fate. Martha DeFrancisco, who is in charge of recording the Philadelphia Orchestra, is also a fellow of the Mahler Institute in Vienna. She explained what Mahler had in mind for the sound.
Ein kurzer, mächtiger, aber dumpf hallender Schlag von nicht-metallischem Charakter, meaning a short, powerful, but dull-sounding hit. And it should not have a metallic character. So it's almost like someone punching your stomach or something like that. So this is about the type of sound that he intended for the hammer.
The Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Christoph Eschenbach, in an excerpt from a November performance of Mahler's Sixth Symphony. In commemoration of Benjamin Franklin's 300th birthday, major cultural and tourist groups in Philadelphia partnered for a year-long celebration. In November, the Philadelphia Orchestra made its contribution by commissioning and performing a symphonic piece based on Franklin's life. Composer Daniel Kellogg created Ben, a four-movement work. Kellogg, who researched Franklin before writing the piece, said fitting Franklin's accomplishments into one orchestral work was a formidable task.
The first thing I did was read, you know, biography. And I was absolutely overwhelmed because there's so many facets of this guy. I mean, that was the thing that struck me first was, you know, we all know about the major things that he did and who he was. But then there's all the stuff that we don't know about. The fact that, like, he's instrumental in starting the U.S. postal system. I mean, how many of us think about the fact that we get mail every day and that's connected to this one man? So it became completely overwhelming to figure out what am I going to do.
In December, an exhibition of rare diamonds closed at the Natural History Museum in London after police suspected the gems were the target of a heist. Earlier in the year, the Philadelphia-based FBI Art Crime Unit recovered a Rembrandt painting stolen 5 years earlier and worth an estimated $36 million. Because of these high-profile cases, we examined the larger field of art and antiquities theft. Robert Whitman, the art crime team's lead investigator who recovered the Rembrandt, said that art theft is a bigger problem than the public realizes. Also in December, the spirit of Philadelphia's great founding father inspired the National Constitution Center to open an 8,000-square-foot exhibition on the life of Benjamin Franklin. We spoke with the exhibit's chief curator, Paige Talbot.
We are talking about Franklin here as the man, not the myth. We're looking at Franklin as somebody who you too can emulate, not the hero. He's the founding father, first founding father who turned 300, and we want you as the visitor to get a better understanding of these people as just like you and me, who had the same foibles, who had the same advantages and disadvantages.
Benjamin Franklin, In Search of a Better World, Chief Curator Paige Talbot. That exhibition is at the National Constitution Center through April. And that's it for another show, and indeed for another year. If you want to hear more about anything mentioned in this show, follow the links to the Creatively Speaking archives at www.wrti.org. Thanks to all our contributors this year, who include Teresa Madden, Leslie Valdez, Susan Lewis, Tom DiNardo, Jason Pfeiffer, and Albert Stumm. This year-end special was written and produced by Albert Stumm. From all of us here, thank you for your support over the last 12 months. We hope you have a healthy and happy 2006. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.